Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Jeff.
On today's show, we open the NLT mailbag. But first, as soon as the trade deadline passed, the autopsy of the 2023 Mets began. Since then, the press has discussed many topics, including Billy Epler, whether Justin Verlander was a diva, the analytics staff, the clubhouse atmosphere, Pete's future, and whether Steve is a good steward of the team. It's all in the press, but one topic the press is not discussing, and that is whether Buck should return in 2024. Here, we're not talking about if he should return, but why it's not even being discussed. He's the manager of a team that was a favorite for the World Series, and instead, that team might finish last. So how is it possible, Greg, that this isn't being discussed?
Interesting question. Again, with the understanding that the press isn't monolithic, I wonder if the fact that the little boomlet that seemed to arise when June was going to hell, which culminated in Steve Cohen having that press conference and saying Buck's not going anywhere for the rest of the year, may have quieted that as a topic. Now, that's the rest of the year. Around the trade deadline in Kansas City when he spoke, I don't remember the exact phrasing, but in so many words, he said 90%. I'm putting a number on that. 90% he's back, but nothing's guaranteed. It may just seem like they've done that topic once. Certain reporters did delve into it. And maybe especially once they started to win a little, maybe that's just the sort of thing that gets talked about more when a team has just gone to hell completely. Now, listen, the team had gone to hell completely twice, more than twice this year. Once we just discussed in June, the other time when they walked out dazed after the trading deadline. Now, for example, and I know we're not trying to pass judgment on Buck, we're just talking about why it's not in the air, let's say. I think the whole enterprise of the New York Mets was in such disarray for a week or so, having traded six different veterans and basically giving up, that there was nothing to judge from. And I'm going to believe that that was understood when you were throwing all these quadruple A players who had just arrived out there. Thereafter, Buck had something to manage and things were looking up. Here's something interesting I noticed, interesting to me, maybe not interesting to all. If you can think back to when the Mets were playing the Pirates, when they ended their most recent homestand and they won a day game, that Tyler McGill pitched pretty well, not well enough to last. And we both know how badly the Mets need length from their starters. Everybody needs length from their starters. But this was during that period where there was just a lot of relief pitching. But because they won it, because McGill went five, I remember there was a question in the post-game session. And again, these people who cover the Mets are used to the way Buck is likely to respond. So they probably frame their questions that way. And in so many words, somebody asked, what about the positives from McGill? Because he always likes to talk positives. Well, they won that day. And Buck took a little bit of a detour into not the positives. Like, well, in so many, again, I'm using the phrase so many words, and I apologize for not having transcripts in front of me. But he said, in so many words, McGill has to do better. McGill has to step up. And that was fascinating to me. Buck doesn't usually go in that direction, the public challenging of his players. And I think when they're not doing so great, it's his read of the room that kid gloves are in order, at least in public. When they've got a little bit of momentum, he can maybe speak a little more truth as he sees it. I have not seen a Tyler McGill start since then while we're talking, so I couldn't tell you if he's had some great discussion with him. But it went beyond the usual, he's working really hard and the other team is trying too. I'm thinking the people who cover the team sort of understand that Buck is doing the best he can and nothing is going to come up. But now if we get to September, and we get later into September and the little blip that we saw mid-late August fades, and we're again talking about a team that is plummeting and that Buck does not have a handle on, I would expect the kinds of stories that you've noticed are missing to start appearing again, because that's just how life works. I went back last night and was looking at, the temperature of Mesopotamia, as I like to call it, when Mickey Calloway's tenure was ending and Luis Rojas's tenure was ending. And in both cases, it felt like fait accompli in those particular years. I think there almost has to be critical mass for something like that to take off when you've got a guy who, whatever disagreements you or I or any Mets fan or Mets observer would have, still well respected in the game, still, this might be a cringy word, still revered in the game. And the people who see him every day, if we're talking about reporters, I think probably have bought into that to a certain degree. Now, that doesn't mean nobody would make the sort of comments you're talking about, because the world is full of talk show hosts who never show up at the ballpark, and columnists who are writing from X hundred or thousand miles away. And everybody has been known to just say, hey, you know who should be on the hot seat? That guy in Cleveland. No offense to the manager in Cleveland. I'm Terry Francona. I don't think they're doing anything with him. I think, I think you actually hit it before. You listed all the things that are being talked about, and there are so many weird angles to this season, certainly the way it unfolded. Things like the Verlander story, which is the kind of thing that gets your attention because it's kind of gossipy and maybe has a grain of utility to it. And, Steve Cohen is going to be an evergreen topic as long as he is the steward, not to be confused with the DJ Stewart of the team. And, all those other things that have been mentioned. So I'll leave it here. If the Mets gather, maintain momentum, make a good showing of themselves, this won't be a topic at all. If, despite all of that, they still finish way out or they take another U-turn and go back to losing, it'll be a topic. I think you just, when you cover a team 162 games a year, when you live with a team 162 games a year, you have to find different angles. And I think the Buck Showalter angle is probably on hiatus for now. No manager escapes it, though.
I think the fact that Steve ruled it out should not preclude the press from discussing it. But I think the main reason is that Buck has been in New York for so long, and so many of these reporters have been in New York for so long, that overall, the press loves Buck. They love him to the extent that I remember right before the trade deadline, a chance for serious questions. Fans were upset about the lineup. There was a lot of trade talk in the air. And the first question at a pregame press conference was, hey, Buck, are you going to see the Barbie movie? I don't think that they talk to him the way they might talk to other managers, certainly not the way they talk to manager up-downs or Mickey Calloway.
Well, then that's part of Buck's skill, if you think about it, that he can sort of, I'm not going to say control the agenda. I don't think he's got people passing out sheets of softball questions like that. But, going back to Calloway, he was awful in those situations, awful pregame, awful postgame, awful explaining his thinking. Not just, I disagree with why he brought in such and such reliever, but just got snippy, to use a word, trying to justify what he did, defensive. This was not something he signed up for. I don't think he realized in New York, people are interested in what the manager is thinking and why he did certain things. Buck understands that. Buck may have helped invent it in the modern era. I mean, I don't remember when exactly it became de rigueur for a manager to sit in a room and have cameras focused on him, and it was shown plausibly live. Reporters always went into the manager's office, but it's more of a show now. And somewhere along the way, Buck probably helped construct that presentation. Yeah, and he's done TV. So he understands how this works. I know we both listen to Keith Olbermann's podcast. Keith likes to tell and rerun a story about dealing with Buck Showalter early on in Buck Showalter's managerial career with the Yankees, where it was obvious that Buck was kind of making it up as he went along. And the upshot of the story was years later, Olbermann runs in to Buck, who had given him a hard time circa 1995, And here, you know, sometime in the last few years, Buck was like, yeah, I realize what I did now. And, you know, the idea is that Buck is not only older and wiser, but he kind of understands the game. Another thing about the people who cover the team, and again, these are the people who were actually there versus, you know, some national baseball writer who just decides that morning, you know what I'm going to write? I'm going to write Buck Showalter needs to go in New York. There is a little bit of eating out of the hand of the manager. You just sort of, I don't want to call it Stockholm syndrome, but I think you just get used to a certain give and take, certain parameters, certain barriers. Don't worry, Buck, I would never tell that. I don't know that it goes that deep. If you watch Winning Time and you see the reporter with the mustache on the team plane and he's drinking it up because, hey, we're off the record. It doesn't quite work like that. But, you know, people have relationships and people don't want to necessarily inflame one of their major on the record sources by writing on Thursday, I'm going to write Buck Showalter needs to go, or why aren't we talking about why Buck Showalter needs to go? And then Friday, I'm going to show up and be like, hey, Buck, how about that Barbie movie? Again, you can do that. Reporters have been known to do that. It's sort of professionals understand that it's not personal, that maybe I have a problem with the way the manager managed Thursday's game, and I'm going to rip that. And then on Friday, though, I'm going to show my face and hopefully everybody can just get along. But, you know, no, again, one more thing about, and again, you know, as long as we're generalizing, you look at the people in the room on any given day. These are people who grew up with Buck Showalter as a major league manager. When I say grew up, I don't mean grew up in the business. I mean, grew up. I'm, you know, people who, even the senior people on the Mets beat were like, you know, maybe 10 years old when Buck Showalter was managing in New York or managing in Arizona, probably a little bit of, at least at first, oh my God, that's Buck Showalter. And I don't know what impact that has. Probably very little as things go along, but it's all part of the equation. I mean, as Met managers go, he's famous. If you think about it, nobody knew who Mickey Callaway was. Nobody knew who Luis Rojas was. Terry Collins became well known in Met circles, certainly, and he was, you know, this revered with a small r baseball man, been around. Buck Showalter was actually a celebrity in the world of baseball. And I don't think he got there just because he made awesome pitching changes in Texas. He knows how to, it sounds nefarious, but he knows how to handle the media. And also, let's give a little credit to the media who again, or representatives therein, who might have decided, this isn't really an angle just now. We did some of those stories. We asked those questions of Steve Cohn. We got as definitive an answer as we can. There is value in waiting and seeing to see how the rest of the season plays out. So let's not just jump on that horse the second we see it wandering around the barn. And I would be surprised that a Mets team that finishes under 500, no matter how strongly they might be finishing down the end of the second half, I'd be surprised if it's not a question that's broached again, unless Cohen preempts it by saying, I'm giving Buck Showalter a 2-year extension or something like that. And then it's kind of off the table. And again, one more X factor, the name that we've heard for 2 years and maybe for real this winter, David Stearns, maybe he's not a Buck Showalter guy. I have no idea. I have no idea if David Stearns will be here to run baseball operations over Billy Epler. But if he is, if for whatever reason, David Stearns says to Steve Cohn, listen, I've got some ideas here, but one of the things I have to be able to do is bring in my own manager, or I don't have that much faith in Buck Showalter, or maybe Buck Showalter conversely decides, you know what, I've had enough. I tried my best. This is all speculation. And again, this is all speculation that could be part of the content you and I are reading. It just isn't at the moment, but it'll come.
I hope so. I hope that they have that discussion. Again, we're not talking about if he should be fired. My opinion on that is known. I put that into a special commentary at the end of June. I just want to have the discussion.
I think one of the other things we could be talking about, though, is this whole idea that we're playing for draft choices now. Isn't that a weird way to look at the season? Or maybe it's the right way to look at the season. I don't know.
I know that some fans are. I'm not. This is not if the Jets win, they finish seventh. But if they lose, they have the fourth highest pick instead of the seventh highest pick. I'm not looking at it that way. I want the Mets to win every day. And at the end of the season, I'll look at the Tankathon website and see where the Mets will draft and their percentage in the draft lottery, assuming that they don't make the playoffs. So to me, this isn't a concern. Is it your concern?
Not really. Listen, if it were 2022, this would be completely off our radar because we were going in the other direction. When the Mets were playing at their absolute worst for a third time this year, tripping all over Baltimore and Kansas City, and then horror show against Atlanta, you couldn't help but notice they were dipping in the standings. And if you looked at the standings, you saw, you know what? There are only a handful of teams that are definitively statistically worse than them. Well, if we're going to fall on our faces, why don't we take a complete header if that has some sort of implication? And then they win a few games and you put that out of your mind. At least I did. I understand that what's the point of worrying whether you win 74 games or 70 games, to pick two numbers out of the air. But the idea that there might be a potential prize because you're just a tiny bit worse than you could have been otherwise, it's bound to dance past your field of vision. But it's not something to root for. I know that the draft culture is more thoroughly embedded in basketball and football because it's a little more obvious that there are often game-changing type players coming out of college and you know who they are. And boy, this terrible team that went 15-67 in the NBA last year, just get this guy. And they're in the playoffs next year. We both know that baseball doesn't function like that. We also would be hard-pressed, unless we're super baseball draft nicks, to be able to tell you about these are the amateurs we have to go get. And you know, this leaves out Latin America where the draft doesn't extend to. So it's all a little much. I understand, because when there's nothing else to root for, there is no wild card race. And I know by the middle of August, some of us were still kind of groping around. Hey, are we actually like a half game behind San Diego and we're only in six outs? And you're entitled to dream for as long as you can. But to go any farther beyond that, listen, you'll do anything to keep yourself engaged, I think. And to say that if 2023 is a moot point, what can we do about 2025? Skipping over 2024, I understand the impulse, but it's a tough thing to want to root for. I can't imagine that come October 1st, the final game of this season, I will be at Citi Field, good health willing, that if the Mets are one game with whatever tiebreakers ahead of, say, the Nationals for that sixth worst spot, I'm going to sit there and say, you know, come on, Francisco, strike out here. We don't need you bringing the runner home from third and queering the deal, to use an old phrase. I don't want to do that. If it happens, it happens. And we'll say, ooh, and you know, we found an extra lucky penny on top of all the guys we got in the end of July, the beginning of August, on top of whoever we drafted in June. Let's get a rabbit's foot, too. Get to that lottery. See if David Stern can pick out the right card on the Mets' behalf the way he did for the Knicks and Patrick Ewing. I know David Stern is no longer with us and has nothing to do with the baseball draft. Y'all know what I'm saying. But you know what? I can't live like that. I can't think about that. I can't watch the game and say, leave this runner on second because next June I want a higher pick and I don't want Steve Cohen to have to deal with luxury tax penalties in the way of a lower pick. Play ball.
I agree with you. And how do you feel about all these breathless reports we receive about the minor leaguers? I follow several minor league experts on Twitter. I'll call it what I want to call it. Almost nightly, there's a Mauricio report, Acuna, Gilbert, Jet Williams, Stewart, Clifford, so many of the bright prospects. They don't tell you when they go 0-for-4. They tell you when they succeed, and sometimes there are highlights. At this point, it's becoming an overload to me. I just want to know when they're ready.
My wife and I have been known to watch a soap opera, a daytime drama, excuse me. When somebody has little children on the show and they want to grow them up fast so they can become full-fledged characters, what do? they send the kids to boarding school. So you'll hear about them maybe twice for a few months. Hey, how's little Schmendrick doing? Oh, he's in boarding school. He loves boarding school. Now let's get back to the intrigue of daytime drama. Then suddenly you turn around one day and Schmendrick, who was born maybe 2 years ago, is now a fully fledged 28-year-old or whatever. Well, no, it's the characters on the show are young and restless. So they're not 28, but you know what I mean. 20, let's say that they're, in college. Let's say they're just out of college. They've come back from boarding school. Fully grown. That's what the minor leagues are for. That is Mets boarding school. I don't need to know what Jet Williams is doing every single night, let alone every single at bat, or any of these other guys. Just do your best, and I won't put any pressure on you. And when there begins to be some word that you're moving up the chain and you can't be stopped, and why aren't you here? I'll dig that. The one name you mentioned that would seem to have some relevance was Ronnie Mauricio. And I think he's a great example of what you said, where he was, again, at Syracuse, so highest level, so that gets your attention, was having a great start to the season. We were hearing about it every night. Well, when's Ronnie Mauricio coming here? And you get some corporate speak from Billy Epler, and maybe you forget about it for a few days. And I realized when they started having to call up guys we weren't thrilled to see because, you know, we never heard of them because nobody was breathlessly reporting on them because they weren't Met prospects. They were quadruple A players. And that's before we fell in love with all of them once they started doing well. But, hey, what about Ronnie Mauricio? Oh, Ronnie Mauricio was not having a good second half at Syracuse. It's like, well, okay, now maybe it's on me to follow that. But I was like, but weren't we just talking about how great Ronnie Mauricio was doing? No, because like you said, we see the highlights. We hear, oh my God, he was 3-for-4 last night. Look at this double into the gap. Well, you know, they should be doing that. And they should also be failing for a week if they have to. It's the minor leagues. That is what that's for. And certainly in the case of guys who are not in AAA, whose trajectory has them heading in that direction, but they're not there yet, leave them be. And I understand there are people who do enjoy reading minor league updates who probably could pass as scouts. They followed closely enough. And I admire that. But for me personally, I sound like a manager. I've got 26 players to worry about. I'm good with the 26 players who are here and knowing that at least a few of them are not going to be here the next day because two pitchers always have to be sent down and two more pitchers have to be called up in their place. And God forbid you should pitch two innings because, you know, you're heading out the door again for at least 10 days if you're not designated for assignment into the wilderness. This is the sort of thing, you know, I was going to say, if the Mets were doing better, you wouldn't be thinking about it as much or you wouldn't be hearing about it as much. But this kind of thing is sort of an evergreen and a perennial, to put it more accurately. I think we always look forward. I'm happy to look forward in broad terms. When somebody's knocking on the door for real, I will grab the doorknob and open it. But until then, enjoy boarding school.
And we'll look forward to seeing them in spring training also. You touched on something there that you mentioned in Faith and Fear. It appears that the quickest way to be sent down is to pitch effectively in relief.
Yeah, if you're not in that circle of trust, which sounds like something from a pharmaceutical ad, you are easy pickings for when they need to have a fresh arm for tomorrow because they don't get the length out of the starters enough. Quintana gives you length, Senga gives you length, and everybody else is a crapshoot. And suddenly you're in the fourth inning and you're going to Vinny Natoli or whoever, and Vinny Natoli's perfectly fine. But you can't afford to leave Vinny Natoli around because then, you know, you might have to use Grant Hartwig tomorrow. Oh, Grant Hartwig already pitched, got to send him down. On and on and on the churn goes. One wonders, how do you build team spirit when the team can't even stay the same team for more than 3 days in a row? And I don't even think that's an exaggeration right now. I think everybody does it. So I don't know that the Mets are unique or at a competitive disadvantage because of this. A little jarring to look up and see number 68 and wonder who the hell number 68 is. And not just in that, who's that? But like literally, who's that?
And before we move on, you mentioned the horror show of the 4 home games against Atlanta, except the first 3 were the horror show. You went, this is over a week ago, to the 1 good game. That was a Sunday night, so you avoided the awful ESPN broadcast. What was that like? What was the atmosphere like after those three terrible games against Atlanta.
As soon as fans went through the turnstiles, we high-fived one another because we weren't going to have to listen to the ESPN announcers. Everybody was just delighted. You go to a baseball game, even in the crummy years, the people who show up are there to have a good time in one way or another. I imagine at that 21-3 loss to the Braves, the good time vibe wore off pretty quickly, and however many people were left by the time it was over, they were entitled to throw verbal, not actual brickbats, whatever brickbats are. It's just one of those phrases I've always seen. But, you know, you show up, summer night, all of that, and you say, hey, it's the Mets. These are people who probably planned to be there for a while. It was, maybe they planned to be at a 140 game. I think this got changed along the way. But still, so it wasn't like everybody's just walking around being, oh, can you believe this terrible team? The atmosphere was fine, and the Mets won that night. The Mets held on, it will be recalled. Again, this was, do we call it Senga night? Well, we can. It was Senga night fever, Senga day night fever. And the Mets were indeed staying alive. They fell behind early. He battened down the hatches. They took a big lead. They nearly blew it. And when they didn't, you know, it was cathartic. I went with a friend of this podcast, Kevin Connell from Flushing. Thank you, Kevin, because every year he and I go to a Brave game together, and that's something he takes care of, and I appreciate that. Great guy, great company. And we just, you know what? I'm a terrible judge of what happens in a game because I end up just kind of yammering away about everything else I've seen in baseball for more than 50 years. And like, oh, did somebody just double? That's right, because I don't keep a scorecard. Shame on me. It was a nice night. It was just so nice not watching on ESPN. And not trying to sync the audio from WCBS with ESPN. It's a little inconvenient. Sunday Night Baseball, I don't know why it exists. I don't think anybody really likes it. I don't think the rest of America is sitting around waiting for that one game on ESPN, but that's another discussion. It was nice to break out of the horror show that was those first three games against the Braves. What was the, it was like 34-3 or something over 3 days? Yeah, it was 34-3 over 3 days. Or three games, because there was a day-night doubleheader. At the time, it felt like we shouldn't even be showing our faces in the same stadium as the Atlanta Braves. But heads held high when it was over.
And now it's time to open the NLT mailbag. Actual letters from actual listeners. And we have three concerning our discussion about fan behavior in the stands. And the first one comes from Jeff Cohn, who is upset about the fans who are oblivious to everyone else around them. They want to make a spectacle of themselves. We discussed the section captain. I think he's talking about somebody who just wants to call attention to themselves without regard to what anybody else cares about.
Yeah, I'll give this to the section captain. The section captain is at least tuned in to the event at hand. So when they're raising the arms and getting you up, at least you get the idea that they care what happens on the field. I think the spectacle is about the spectacle, and the spectacle has gotten out of the house or wherever for 3 hours, and this is the spectacle's time to shine. Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm doing something crazy. I'm yelling things and buying beer or whatever. Yeah, let's hope the spectacle is not in the row in front of Jeff Cohn or us.
The aforementioned Kevin Connell writes, and this is a good one because this is one of my bugaboos. I discussed fans that come back to their seats after going to the concourse, and they do it without regard to what's going on in the game. Kevin Connell talks about people who come back from the concourse, and they don't remember where they sat. They don't remember where to go. Do I go left? Do I go right? What row I'm in? They have no clue. That's a great point, Kevin.
Do you know where you're going to? And too often, you do not. I'm remembering a Sunday afternoon in September 2005, Shea Stadium, where my friend and I happened to be sitting in a section where everybody who'd been on the field pregame for some sort of presentation, community service, or maybe it was just, I don't know, Bethpage Day at the ballpark. Like, they all were sitting around us, and they kind of came in dribs and drabs, and none of them knew how. Again, this is the days of actual tickets in your hand and signage that identified the section and the row and the seat number. People just stood there completely without any feel for numbers and the ability to put it together in their mind that, oh, I'm in row D, that must be the fourth row, let me keep walking. It was more just a matter of, let me stand here and stare into space because I've never sat in a place with assigned seating before. That's what Kevin's comment reminds me of. But yeah, what once you've gotten to your seat in the first place, once you've been to the game, and I know sometimes you'll come up one bank of stairs at one side of the section as opposed to the one you left from, and you'll be slightly disoriented, and maybe you're not there that often. And okay, you know, not that big a deal, but it does seem like something that you get the hang of time and space, you get back to your seat, and you're not standing in front of somebody else. And I think that's really the key. If we want to be distracted at the game, we wish to distract ourselves. We don't need your help. Thank you.
Speaking of standing, Mark Simon of Sports Info Solutions says, I like standing during playoff games. He makes the point that during a playoff game, it's okay to stand.
Absolutely okay to stand, but baseball, to me, I think makes you want to sit down every now and then. Again, runners on base, seventh inning, tie game. Oh my God, why would you be sitting if you have the ability to stand? But getting up for every strike too, I think is probably what I was referring to some time ago on this count, and just sort of taking the edge off the experience pretty quickly. But I understand it's a playoff game. The stakes are higher. The price was higher. You want to feel like everything you're doing matters. And if you could jump out of your seat and take the at bat, or perhaps take the shift in some other sport that Mark might have been to a playoff game for in recent times, you would do it yourself. The next best thing is to stand up and shout, or at least absorb the experience that way. But as with everything, there are ways and there are ways. And knowing Mark Simon, I imagine if he's the person standing in front of me at a playoff game, it would not bother me, because a fan who is there for the sake of the game innately knows what to do. People who just feel, again, I come back to section captaining and that sort of thing. How dare you be sitting down, be on your feet, yell, I will make that decision. Thank you very much.
I like your point about picking your spots. We both love Bruce Springsteen. I saw Bruce earlier in the year, and the guy in front of me stood for the entire 2.5 hours. The entire 2.5 hours. Pick your spots. It's okay to stand during Badlands. You don't have to stand during Kitty's Back.
Unless that's your stand song, a spot picking. You know, the very first time I saw Dwight Gooden pitch in a regular season game, because I did see him in spring training as a rookie, it wasn't until August of 1984, by which point he was a full-blown phenomenon. And I hadn't gotten to see him yet. I was out of town most of that year. Finally get back to New York, go to Shea Stadium. He gets two strikes on. All I've experienced is what I've read and what I've seen on TV. I want to be a part of this. And I'm jumping on my feet, you know, doing the clapping with the two strikes and all of that. And somebody had to tell me, hey, could you sit down? I realized, yeah, you know what? This is excessive on my part. And, you know, I was young then. I had energy. But I also understand that you can't treat the strikeout in the first inning, even if it's your first time seeing Dr. K, the same as you would treat this going for the strikeout, the seventh, eighth, ninth inning. Again, if this is really who you are, if you're really out of your seat because you just absolutely cannot sit down because Doc is performing or Bruce is performing or Curtis Granderson is up against the Cubs in game one of the NLCS, I'm with you in spirit. I just may want you to just duck a little bit so I can take a moment. I always wonder, just per your point about a concert, I always wonder about concert girl, who the concert girl who is always just not only on her feet, but kind of swaying back and forth for 3 hours. Maybe she's on her boyfriend's shoulder. Now it's getting really hard to see. Would you mind? And yeah, you don't want to take away from anybody's good time. I mean, this can border on a religious experience, certain concerts, certain ball games, but you've got people around you. So, and especially you mentioned Bruce. Those are long shows. Calibrate. That's the word I'm looking for. Calibrate. But the ball leaves the bat. You have every right to stand and deliver, just like, say, Ioannis Cespedes. To make a contemporary reference, he goes deep. You know, none of us who can stand are sitting.
You can observe how you want, but be cognizant that everybody else might not observe the same way you do. We received two letters about last week's show. Friend of the pod, Dave Bagdade, wrote, "Of all of the many great moments you've offered on NLT, and there have been a lot, Greg's Bob Murphy tribute has to be near the top of the list." Wow. I agree with you. It was very touching for me, and I didn't respond in kind, one, because I got a little choked up, but I didn't want to detract from the powerful words that Greg conveyed. So I am glad that Dave wrote to us about that.
That was very nice of Dave, and I appreciate that. I'll let you folks in on a secret. Some of that was adopted from something I wrote on Faith and Fear 15 years ago. I don't know why I should feel apologetic about that, because it was closer to the actual date at the time. That was the year that Shea Stadium was going down, and I was writing a series of remembrances of games I'd been to and focused in on those Bob Murphy occasions. When I got to that part, I think it was somehow fresher than merely recalling it in 2023. But it was real. I would tell Dave or anybody that the two things that just had a hard time dealing with as they closed in were the end of Shea Stadium and the end of Bob Murphy's Mets career, because he was the constant by the early 2000s, more so than Ralph Kiner, because Ralph was on TV and some games, but not that many games. And some games were on Fox Sports New York, some were on MSG, some were on Channel 11, which, by the way, doesn't that still sound weird? Shouldn't they all be on Channel 9? But that's another story. But and Bob, even though his schedule was curtailed toward the end, you know, that was the radio all those years, which is such a part of your life. The idea that someday Bob Murphy wasn't going to be there was stunning. And then to have it, you know, that was in theory, it was stunning. So to have it actually have a date on it, as it did, September 25th, 2003, was something that was tough to realize and tough to say, yeah, next year, Bob Murphy will not be part of the Mets. So I think we all get emotional thinking about people like that in our lives. But let's, as they say, let's be happy that for 42 years, we did have Bob Murphy. We're talking about a guy who last did a Met game 20 years ago, and we still talk about him almost in the present tense as a part of the Mets experience. So the fact that he gave us all of that, and he imbued the DNA of Met broadcasting into two very worthy recipients in the next generation, in Howie Rose and Gary Cohn, both of whom he worked with directly, both of whom grew up on Bob Murphy's calls along with Lindsay's and Ralph's. It's something to celebrate regularly, and I'm glad that whatever we talked about last week contributes to that emotion.
And how we broadcast from the Bob Murphy broadcast booth.
Brought to you by Bigelow Tea.
Tea proudly. And the name of my fantasy team is the Bob Murphy Fan Club. John Lyons wrote, "I really enjoyed this episode. The conversation about the human beings that play sports that we root for was a fascinating exploration of the issue that almost inevitably confronts the thinking fan, but is rarely talked about." That struck a chord with many of our listeners. The as Joni Mitchell puts it, the devil's bargain between rooting for your team, but not necessarily liking the values and politics of players on that team. And I think that was a good conversation. I'm glad John Lyons appreciated it.
Yeah, don't necessarily look too deeply into who the owner of the New York Met, some of the causes he might have supported, or some of his past doings. And don't do too much research into who sits on the board of directors of the New York Mets. That's all I'm going to say. The word that occurred to me after our conversation, compartmentalization. We probably do it in a lot of our lives, and we're certainly entitled to, because I don't think any of us became fans of the Mets or whatever we're fans of because we did a little digging and found out that the player on the team shared the same thoughts on such and such issue. No, they're on our team, and we like them in a context that we hope is separate from anything else, if in fact that anything else is something that would make us cringe a little. I appreciate that others appreciated that, and it's something we'll probably continue to grapple with as long as we are human beings, and we can either compartmentalize, we can embrace, or we can just say, you know what, this would be a good time to go get another soft drink while such and such is coming in from the bullpen.
Our final letter is from Sharon Chapman, who wrote extolling the virtues of the announcers on ESPN Español, especially during the home run derby.
That is always Sharon's advice. Whenever I start to roll my eyes at the Fox announcers, the ESPN announcers, she says, ESPN Deportes, oh, they're so good. And it leaves me wondering, and I've listened sometimes, and it's very entertaining, but I don't understand what they're saying. I wonder how many Spanish-speaking fans watch those broadcasts and say, I can't stand ESPN Deportes. I'm going to go listen to the English-speaking announcers. I don't know what they're saying, but at least I can enjoy the game this way. I once, on there, somebody put out a DVD back when that was a thing, as they say, a DVD series called Baseball's Greatest Games, and one of them was the no-hitter. And it gave you the option to watch the SNY broadcast, which if you are an SNY subscriber, you'll see about once a week still. You could listen to the radio broadcast that aired on what was, it was still WFAN, was the Met flagship, which that night was interesting because the team then was Howie and Josh Lewin. But Josh, I believe his daughter was graduating from high school. He wasn't there. Jim Duquette was the color analyst for the first no-hitter in Mets history. And Jim Duquette was wise enough to keep mum in the ninth inning and let Howie do his thing. And there was the Spanish language radio broadcast in which I had very little idea what they were saying, despite 6 years in junior high and high school of taking Spanish. But it was a sight, or a sound, I should say, a sound to behold. And if you thought Gary was excited when he says, it has happened, and Howie was excited when he said, put it in the history books. Brother, you don't know excitement until you've listened to the Met radio broadcast in Spanish of Johan Santana's no-hitter. So if you come across that DVD, go to the menu, search out that option. It's a whole other level of excitement. And I guess when you watch the home run derby, something like that, when it's all just about saying, look, another home run, if you can say it excitedly and not bother people with extraneous ESPN nonsense, maybe you do go in that direction. So I'm glad Sharon enjoys that and has turned us on to that. We're a hero a few weeks ago, as I recall, when the Mets had a game on Apple TV Plus, and you taught America what you could do when watching the Mets on Apple TV Plus. Could you share that?
There's a nice feature of the MLB broadcasts on Apple TV, which I don't think are terrible. I like their graphics. The win probability graphics, always weird to watch as it changes between pitches. But I like the graphics. And of course, Wayne Randazzo, our former radio friend, is an announcer. But if you look closely, you can change the settings of the audio. So that is the home or away team's radio broadcast. And it syncs up perfectly. So you were able to listen to Howie and Keith Rad instead of the national TV announcers. And I talked about it, got a lot of traction that night. So I was glad to share that and help people. I only wish that ESPN did that. And I certainly wish that Fox did that. So we wouldn't have to listen to the stylings of John Smoltz.
I wonder, for all the great pitching and obviously all the great coaching he got as a pitcher, who told John Smoltz he has a personality? Because I've run it through some tests and I can find no trace of personality, just a good bit of droning and the occasional anecdote about growing up in Michigan or Leo Mazzoni or whatever. I will say this for national telecasts, and I think one of the things that holds us back from embracing national telecasts, and this isn't an original thought by any means, is that they come to you as if you, the viewer, have not watched a baseball game all year, that you have not watched the team or teams in question all year, that you have limited awareness of what these franchises are, and that kind of gets on your nerves because, yeah, I know when the Mets played the Red Sox, I know they played each other in 1986, and that the Red Sox have won several World Series since then, and the Mets haven't, and we don't have to pound that home, and you don't have to tell me who Pete Alonso is, and that sort of thing. And by the same token, I don't know that I need to be given a tutorial in the Red Sox or the Braves or whoever the Mets are playing. But there is also, and maybe this speaks to why sometimes I hang in there and don't go to the Spanish language telecast or don't sync up the radio call, and revel in Howie and Keith. But I just kind of like to know what the conversation is. This is what, for lack of a better phrase, what people will be talking about throughout the game, the next day. It's just there are insights to be had, and there are other angles. That feeling usually lasts. The over-under is an inning and a half, and then I run screaming. But sometimes I do like to kind of get a feel for it way back, but before it felt like a curse instead of a blessing that your team was, quote, good enough to have on national TV. It was instructive to hear what the Monday Night Baseball crew had to say about your Mets, or what the Saturday afternoon game of the week had to say about your Mets, whoever the announcers were. Over time, that fascination wore off, and you just want your warm blanket of your own voices who know the team and are talking to you. And if you learn something about the other team, it will be well earned because Gary Cohn or Howie Rose wouldn't steer you wrong, but the guy on ESPN or the guy on Fox or Apple TV Plus, and I agree with you, it's great to hear Wayne Randazzo's voice on there. When they're not doing Apple TV Plus shtick, it can be interesting, but ultimately, you're not looking necessarily to be challenged. You're looking to enjoy yourself, enjoy your team, enjoy your game, enjoy your voices. So, whatever the language, let's hear it for the Mets.
And we enjoyed your letters. If you want to be part of the show, write to us, nationalleaguetown@gmail.com. Before we go, a behind-the-scenes look at your favorite Mets podcast. Last week, you may have noticed that we mentioned two things that were outdated by the time the show aired. A year ago, when the Mets were closing in on the playoffs, Greg and I recorded the show on Wednesdays or Tuesdays at the earliest, so the show would be timely before it dropped on Thursday. This year, the games aren't as important, unfortunately, so we're recording them at our convenience. Last week and this week, we're recording them on Sunday because that's the only times that we can meet. Because of that, sometimes the information gets a little outdated, and you may have noticed that we get a little vague in the Mets' recent play. It's because we're recording 4 days in advance. So last week we mentioned Daniel Murphy. We didn't mention that his quest to return to the majors had ended between Sunday and when you heard the show on Thursday. I mentioned Sam Coonrod, and I said that he will be a Met before the season ends. He was a Met between Sunday and Thursday. So that's a little behind the scenes look at National League Town.
Also, my incisive critique on President Coolidge's economic policies might be a little outdated because we recorded that in 1923. Coolidge's administration isn't as great as we thought it was going to be. So we thought we'd get it out of the way. We didn't realize we weren't going to have a podcast until 2023. So sometimes these things do happen.
That'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week with more. We thank you for listening. So until next week, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm standing for this entire podcast because that's how excited I am. I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Their latest album, From Coma to Catharsis, is now available on vinyl. For more information and tour dates, check them out on Bandcamp.